Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Gareth Barlow, and in the early hours of Monday, the 2nd of January, these are our main stories. Brazil's Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva is inaugurated as president once more, 20 years after he was first elected. Ukraine's armed forces say they've destroyed dozens of attack drones launched by Russia. Rescue workers in Vietnam raced to save a boy who fell into a hollow concrete pillar at a construction site. Also in this podcast...
This is a day for the history books. But above all, this is a day of joy and pride.
The youngest member of the EU, Croatia, joins the Euro and the visa-free travel zone. And North Korea marks the new year with another missile test. We begin in Brazil, where Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has been sworn in as president. He told Congress he would rebuild the country for what he called the terrible ruins he'd inherited from Jair Bolsonaro. He then addressed huge crowds waiting for him outside.
Na luta pelo bem do Brasil.
In the fight for the good of Brazil, we will use the weapons that our adversaries fear the most. Truth, which has prevailed over lies. Hope, which has conquered fear. And love, which has defeated hate. Long live Brazil, and long live the Brazilian people.
Our correspondent, Katie Watson, who's in the capital, Brasilia, is following developments.
The ceremony was very much based on rebuilding Brazil and unity. Those are the kind of key words that kept on being repeated. It's a motto that the new government has included as well, because this is such a divided country. I mean, here in Brasilia, of course, it's an incredibly happy day for, 300,000 Lula supporters who have come to see their leader back in power. But you do have to remember this is a country where Lula narrowly won. There are plenty of people who support Jair Bolsonaro who feel that Lula should never have come back to power. He was a man who was convicted of corruption, spent time in jail. Those charges were annulled, but that is not good enough for his adversaries. And so that's what he is facing. And that's what he has promised to rebuild Brazil, to be able to rebuild people's confidence and address issues here in Brazil for the people who have been suffering. So that was his big commitment. Of course, this was an inauguration that has not been like any other. You know, Jair Bolsonaro was meant to hand over his presidential sash to Lula, but he flew off to Florida a couple of days ago because he didn't want to see him face to face. So it's been an inauguration with a difference, certainly.
Brazil knows Lula. At the end of the day, he's been president before. But like you say, he has a huge job on his hand to bring unity, to fulfil that pledge of rebuilding the country. How does he do that now that the real work starts? Does he bring in some of those adversaries into his government? Does he start handing out handouts to people to try and bring the nation closer to him? What is his tactic going to be?
I think that's the million-dollar question. It's going to be his biggest challenge, because these aren't people who felt that, you know, there was a slightly better candidate they wanted rather than Lula. A lot of the people who didn't vote for Lula really, really didn't want Lula in power. And I think that's going to be his biggest challenge for the next 4 years. I mean, this country is hugely divided. There was extra security around Lula as he was sworn in because of threats from Jair Bolsonaro's far-right supporters. It's going to be a very difficult path for him to tread, especially because although he's the same politician, it's not the same Brazil. He ruled Brazil during very buoyant economic times last time. He managed to use those buoyant times for handouts to be able to help millions of people out of poverty. It's not the same Brazil. It's not the same economic situation. He's going to have to be much tougher when it comes to money, and that's not going to make it as easy to rule. So I think everybody's watching that. But you speak to people here and they say that he's able to change. He knows those challenges and they still have faith in him.
The BBC's Katie Watson. Well, let's explore now what we can expect from President Lula in terms of foreign policy. Celso Amorim was Lula's foreign minister between 2003 and 2010. He's now a senior foreign policy advisor to the incoming president. The BBC's John Donaldson asked him how President Lula's foreign policy would differ from that of his predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro.
Well, it will differ totally. You know, during Lula's government, I was foreign minister, so I accompanied all the time during the 8 years of his two terms. And Brazil was very present in all questions, in WTO, in Security Council, when we were non-permanent members, Brazil was present in any question. And then with Bolsonaro, Brazil became, according to the words of his own foreign minister, Brazil became a pariah, an international pariah. And apart from that, Brazil started to be seen as a kind of a villain, especially in the question of climate, but also human rights, women's rights, and all that. So all that will change.
I guess one of the biggest challenges diplomatically for President Lula will be balancing the relationship with the United States and also that relationship with China, which is, of course, Brazil's biggest trading partner. How's he going to go about that?
It's a difficult task. I agree with you. But it has to be take place because Brazil will not make options. We will have great and traditional friendship with the United States. We have many things in the United States that we admire very much. But as you said, China is our biggest trading partner and we don't want to be hostile to China in any way. So we'll balance pragmatism and idealism.
And what about the relationship with Russia and the attitude towards the war in Ukraine? Because I think President Lula said in an interview with Time magazine that President Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian leader, and Russia's President Putin bore equal responsibility for that war. Is that a position he's going to stick to? And how unpopular will that be with the rest of the international community?
First, very clearly, Brazil condemns any violation of the UN Charter. There's no doubt about that. We condemn the invasion of Ukraine and we cherish very much the principle of integrity of states. So there is no doubt about that. On the other hand, we think that we have to look for the future and not so much to see who is the culprit, but how to solve the question. The world cannot have a war in the heart of the geopolitical center of Europe. And if you can in any way contribute to peace, we will. Of course, you know, our means are limited, but there may be a certain number of countries that can have good relations with the different parts will be there. The world has changed very much, but Brazil will face the big challenges, which are today inequality, which continues, of course, climate change and peace.
That was Celso Amorim speaking to the BBC's John Donison, and the pair of them there picking up on the issue of Ukraine. Well, for its part, Ukraine's armed forces say that they've destroyed dozens of attack drones launched by Russia since New Year's Eve. Officials say more than 40 were shot down on the night of Saturday into Sunday alone in cities across the country. At least one person died and dozens were injured in the attacks. The NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has warned the West that it must be prepared to provide long-term support to ensure the survival of Ukraine as a sovereign country. From Kyiv, Hugo Bashega reports.
In the first hours of the new year, Russia attacked Kyiv again. As the air defences shot down the explosive drones, people sang Ukraine's national anthem in their balconies. The strikes fueled anger among Ukrainians, already tired of Russia's unrelenting air campaign targeting cities across this country. The head of police in the Kyiv region posted a photo of what he said was a fragment of a drone used in the attack. It had a message written on it in Russian saying, "Happy New Year." Hours earlier, President Zelensky delivered a defiant and emotional address. He praised Ukrainians for resisting the Russian aggression and said his country had no option other than to fight until victory. In Russia, a different tone from President Putin. Surrounded by soldiers, he repeated claims that he was defending Russia and indicated that the war would not stop. The head of the NATO military alliance, Jens Stoltenberg, said the West should continue to support Ukraine.
We need to be prepared for long haul because what we have seen is that Russia has shown no sign of giving up its overall goal of taking control over Ukraine. The Ukrainian forces have had the momentum for several months, but we also know that Russia has mobilized many more forces.
The indications, he said, were that Russia had no desire to end the war at present, and could in fact try to launch a new offensive.
That report by Hugo Bashega. Croatia has started the new year with a new currency. It's adopted the euro and also became the 27th nation in the Schengen area, which allows people to travel without border checks. Croatia's prime minister said the country had completed its strategic goals of fully joining Europe. And speaking at a ceremony at one of Croatia's border crossings with Slovenia, the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, heralded the developments as extraordinary successes.
This is a day for the history books. But above all, this is a day of joy and pride for the Croatian people. It is testimony of your amazing journey, your hard work and your determination.
I spoke to our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay for more details.
When they joined the European Union in 2013, they had to make a commitment to join the euro. And there was a referendum before they joined the European Union, which included, importantly, the fact that at some point down the line, the kuna, which is the national currency of Croatia, would go and the euro would be adopted. That's a commitment that all new member states of the European Union now have to make. But once Croatia had satisfied everybody that they were not going to be a threat to the euro, then they were allowed to join. And this has gone ahead 1st of January 2023, new year, new currency.
What do you think now joining the eurozone and the Schengen area will mean for the country and its integration?
For Croatia, a great deal of its income comes from tourism. So more than a fifth of its GDP is created by tourism. Until now, when you crossed over the border into Croatia, the first thing you would see were little exchange offices, menjačnica. This could be very confusing for people because they didn't quite have a calculator in their head which would work out how many kuna there were to a euro. There were some infamous chances, like a bakery which was selling slices of pizza, which turned out to be about 65 euros for a slice of pizza, for example, at one popular tourist island in Croatia. All of this now is going to be a lot more transparent, and that's going to be a big benefit for Croatia's tourism industry. The other thing which is going to have a big impact, possibly even bigger, vis-a-vis tourism, is the accession to the Schengen zone, the border-free zone. There are no longer any border controls between Croatia and its neighbours, Slovenia and Hungary. And bearing in mind that that's the way in which most tourists arrive into Croatia, it's now going to be much more attractive as a tourist destination.
So that's tourism. What impact is expected on the population itself?
Well, Croatia's certainly suffered from its young people leaving since it joined the European Union in 2013. You ended up with a large number of young Croats in the Republic of Ireland, because the Republic of Ireland was the first country which accepted Croatians to go and work there after they joined the EU in 2013. The question is, will it now make Croatia a more attractive place for people to stay? I think the answer is probably yes, because it's going to be easier for people to invest in Croatia. It's going to be easier for people to know what sort of value they're getting in Croatia. That could create a much more dynamic and prosperous economic environment, and that will encourage young people to see their future in the country.
The BBC's Guy Delaunay. It's 30 years to the day since Czechs and Slovaks went their separate ways without a great deal of fanfare. Unlike the breakup of Yugoslavia, the dissolution of Czechoslovakia was entirely peaceful, and today the two countries enjoy a harmonious, largely friction-free relationship. So how will they be looking back on their divorce 30 years on? Rob Cameron has this report from the border.
It's a freezing December afternoon here at the Hodonín Rowing Club, in the very southeast corner of the Czech Republic. The club's chairman, Filip Švrček, is coaching a pair of teenage rowers on the indoor machine. It's too cold to take a boat out, but you can tell Filip, who spent all of his 41 years here by the River Morava, is itching to get back on the water.
Yes, we are on the right side of the Morava River, which is the border of the Czech Republic.
So just across that bank there, that's Slovakia.
It's Slovakia, but for us it's almost the same place.
But does that cause problems for you as a rowing club? Do you need permission to go to that side of the river, or does nobody care about that sort of stuff?
No, we don't need anything, and I hope never we will need anything.
Filip, whose wife is Slovak, was just 11 when Czechoslovakia divided into two at midnight on New Year's Eve 1992. His memory of it is a child's memory. Some excitement, confusion, alarm perhaps, but any emotions have long since subsided. In town at the Masaryk Museum, The director, Irena Chovančíková, is showing me the exhibit devoted to Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk, the Hodonín boy who went on to become the founding father of Czechoslovakia. Garrigue was his American wife Charlotte's maiden name. Masaryk was an early advocate of women's rights. This was her piano. One wonders what Masaryk, son of a Slovak coachman and a Czech cook, would make of his treasured creation being dismembered after just 75 years. I ask Irena what she thought of the split.
Well, it is a shame. What's really sad is the way it was broken up. The politicians simply got together and decided it without asking us. There was no referendum. But on the other hand, Europe was already in the process of uniting and erasing its borders, so there wasn't such a need to miss Czechoslovakia.
A few minutes' drive and I'm in Slovakia, in the little town of Holíč, just across the river from Hodonín. That evening, I stop by an evening of folk dancing in a local hotel. There, I meet one of the dancers, Miroslav Milota, a Holíč man who's been commuting to Hodonín for 42 years.
I remember that New Year's Eve, 1992. I remember we sang the Czechoslovak anthem, both parts, the Czech verse and then the Slovak one. It was emotional. We realized that from now on, we'd only be singing our own half. So we didn't really know what was going to happen. How everything else, not just the anthem, would be divided.
Today, Czechs and Slovaks are best friends. Ordinary people may have had no say in it, but their fast-track divorce is very much in the past.
That report from Rob Cameron on the Czech-Slovak border. The Colombian government has announced a ceasefire with five of the country's main armed groups, including the ELN and the Gulf Clan paramilitary cartel. Mr. Petro said it was a bilateral ceasefire, which was supposed to last 6 months. Jose Quit reports.
On the last night of the year, Colombia's first left-wing president, Gustavo Petro, made an announcement many had been waiting for. His government agreed to a six-month ceasefire with the five largest armed groups operating in the country. This truce was one of Petro's main election campaign pledges. He's trying to implement a policy known as Paz Total, or Total Peace. It hopes to put an end to 5 decades of armed conflict between the state and left-wing guerrilla groups, right-wing paramilitaries, and drug traffickers. The ceasefire will last until 30th of June and could be extended depending on negotiations. Many feel skeptical about the news. So far, the government is struggling to contain the violence engulfing Colombia, and other negotiations and peace deals made by previous governments have failed to bring peace to Colombia.
Jose Cato. Still to come in this podcast.
We are dancers. We dance for Ukraine. Our dance, it's our voice. Our movements, it's our words.
Nearly a year into Russia's war with Ukraine, a troupe of displaced Ukrainian dancers are using ballet to fight back. Sandeep Singh was one of India's most famous sporting heroes, and he's resigned now as Haryana State Sports Minister following a complaint of sexual harassment. More from our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasan Etarajan.
Police in the capital, Chandigarh city, they have launched an investigation after a junior women athletics coach. They accused him of sexual misconduct and also that he was following her on social media, sexually harassing her by sending her several messages for months. And once she was called into his residence, and that's where the alleged incident said to have happened. Now, this case has got a huge attention even beyond Haryana state because of the celebrity status of Sandeep Singh, the former hockey player. So several women organizations held a protest that put pressure on the government. You know, following the Me Too movement in India itself, there have been a number of cases of sexual harassment, and it got prominent media attention. And Sandeep Singh has stepped aside. He said he was handing over the Sports and Youth Affairs Ministry to the Chief Minister, and he will come back once his name is cleared.
So like you say, he's fighting the accusations. Tell us more about the man. He's a colourful character. He's a very famous character too.
He was a hockey player, a very famous hockey player. And in field hockey, India is very well known. It used to be a big power in field hockey. So he was a very popular player. And what was interesting was that many thought he will never play hockey again in 2007 when he was traveling in a train a few days before the Hockey World Cup. And accidentally, a railway policeman fired a gun. A bullet went through his waist and many thought he will not even play hockey again. He was on a wheelchair for several months, but he managed to come back. So people were admiring his courage and his determination to come back. You know, that also inspired this movie, Bollywood movie, Surma. I talked about Sandeep Singh's life. And that is what is, you know, making this case more in terms of media attention. But he strongly denies those accusations. He always says, maintained that this was nothing but an attempt to malign his character. People are, you know, trying to frame in a false cases, and he rejects them as baseless.
The voice there of Ambarasan Etarajan. North Korea and concerns about its nuclear ambitions have been dwarfed by the war in Ukraine in recent months. But 2023 was only a few hours old when the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, marked the new year with another missile test and another typically bellicose speech. Addressing his ruling Workers' Party, Mr. Kim said North Korea would focus on mass-producing tactical nuclear weapons. Our correspondent in South Korea, Jean McKenzie, has more details.
He set out what weapons he wants to develop going forward, and also when he would use his nuclear weapons. So the headline that we've seen today, which has sort of grabbed attention, is that he wants to increase his nuclear weapons exponentially. And that might seem like posturing, but what he's saying is that he wants to stockpile more nuclear weapons, particularly tactical nuclear weapons, which he's been talking about for quite some time now. So these are nuclear weapons that he would be able to use on the battlefield, so against South Korea in a kind of warlike scenario. But he's also outlined today that he's prepared to use these weapons not just to prevent a war, which is what North Korea has always said that it would use its nuclear weapons for, that they were a deterrent, but that he would be prepared to use them in a war, to win a war. Again, that is something that we've heard before, but really I think the takeaway from today is that after a record-breaking year of weapons testing last year, North Korea is going to continue testing, refining, and trying to expand its nuclear weapons arsenal. Here in South Korea, yeah, we've got a new hardline president who came to office really saying that he was going to be tough on North Korea. So what you have now is when North Korea tests a weapon, South Korea retaliates, sometimes with the help of the United States. And essentially it's got people here worried because, you know, one mistake, one miscalculation, and the situation could spiral. There are some people who believe that even potentially some sort of military confrontation between both sides is on the cards, the way this is heading.
Reporting from South Korea, Jean McKenzie. Now to southern Vietnam, where, as we record this podcast, rescue workers are racing to save a 10-year-old boy who has fallen inside a narrow concrete pillar at a construction site in Dong Thap province. More details from our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton.
The boy and his friends were scavenging the site for scrap metal on New Year's Eve when he fell down the vertical pillar measuring 25 centimetres in diameter. The boy's father said he could hear his child's calls for help when he first searched the site, but it has since gone quiet. Photos from the scene show the boy's parents watching anxiously as workers use heavy equipment to excavate the pillar, which has been anchored 35 metres below ground.
Celia Hatton. Nearly a year into Russia's war with Ukraine, a troupe of displaced Ukrainian dancers are using ballet to fight back. More than 70 of them are living and training together at the former Royal Conservatoire in the Dutch city of The Hague. Our correspondent Kate Vandy has been to visit them.
As a group of ballet dancers move gracefully around a hall, it's hard to believe that every single one of them recently fled war.
Now every Ukrainian has his own battlefield.
This is Alexei Knishkov, the principal dancer for the newly formed United Ukrainian Ballet. And his battlefield is the stage.
We are dancers. We dance for Ukraine. Our dance is our voice. our movements, it's our words. We want to speak about Ukraine.
Alexei is one of more than 70 displaced dancers who now make up the group. It was founded in March last year in direct response to the war and aims to protect and spread a culture that has been threatened by this conflict. The troupe have been taking performances of classics such as Giselle and Swan Lake all over the world, raising money that will in turn help the Ukrainian people. But the idea of performing a ballet by Russian composer Tchaikovsky in the current context has created a mix of opinion among the dancers.
I think it is important to block Russian dance in the world.
This is Vladislav Bondar, dancing in bright yellow trousers and a blue shirt when we meet him, now the very well-known colours of the Ukrainian flag.
I think we need a quarantine from it now. Maybe not forever, but for me personally, at this moment, it is not right.
He thinks abandoning Russian ballet will help put an end to the war sooner.
This will also have an impact on Russians. People there will more quickly reflect on what they're doing.
United Ukrainian Ballet's manager Taras Onyshenko understands not all of his dancers will want to perform Swan Lake right now.
If some people don't want to dance, it's their choice. Tchaikovsky is a great composer that belongs to the world, not to Putin or Putin's regime.
Traditionally, the broadcast of Swan Lake was a sign of political upheaval. Soviet state TV interrupted programming by airing the ballet on a loop after the deaths of multiple leaders, as well as during a failed coup attempt against Gorbachev in 1991.
We danced Swan Lake for many, many years, but after the beginning of the war, everything got a new context for us.
So for other dancers, performing this ballet means reinventing it and using it as a way to remind the world about the war. Alexei was one of the dancers who recently took Swan Lake on tour across Australia and Singapore.
Swan Lake turns from a sentimental story about struggle between good and evil sides to a story about evil totalitarian leader Rothbard, which wants to control and use everything around him in his own interests. He cheats and lies to get more power, but in the end he loses everything and dies. Love wins, truth wins, freedom wins.
That report by our correspondent Kate Vandy. In his traditional New Year's Day address in St. Peter's Square, Pope Francis has praised his predecessor, Benedict XVI, who died yesterday. Pope Francis urged the thousands who'd gathered at the Vatican to thank God for the former pope, who he called a faithful servant of the gospel and the church. The body of Benedict, who was 95, will lie in state for 3 days before a funeral on Thursday. Our religion editor, Ali McBall, watched the pope's address.
Buongiorno e buon anno.
From the Vatican balcony, Pope Francis gives a homily every Sunday. But it was 40,000 people that poured into St. Peter's Square to attend this one.
In queste ore invochiamo...
And to hear him call on them all to join together in prayer for the man he called a gift, a faithful servant to the gospel and to the church. Of course, for many, that man, Pope Benedict, had a legacy that was overshadowed by inaction against those who'd perpetrated abuse, something I put to the German bishop, Bertram Meyer, who knew him for many years.
On the one hand, we can say that also Pope Benedict, as Archbishop of Munich, he was not so strong in these affairs. But on the other hand, we must say, also as Pope, during all his pastoral visits, one meeting was dedicated to persons who suffered by the church.
Over the coming days, many thousands more are expected to travel here to pay their respects. First, during 3 days of lying in state, and then the funeral on Thursday morning.
Aline McBull. Queen Margrethe of Denmark has said in her New Year's address that she was saddened by the rift that's emerged in her family over her decision back in September to abolish the royal titles of four of her grandchildren. The children of her younger son Joachim will no longer bear the titles of prince or princess from the beginning of 2023. Rebecca Wood reports.
If you've ever watched the TV series The Crown, you'd expect there to be a lot of drama that goes on in the lives of a royal family. And it's no different in Denmark. Back in September, Queen Margrethe made the announcement that she'd be stripping four of her grandchildren of their royal titles. And she said she wished to remove them so the children could have greater freedom without royalty restricting their careers and lives. And as the clock struck midnight in Denmark, that decision became reality. So, from now on, the children of her youngest son, Prince Joachim, will no longer be known as Prince or Princess, but instead as Counts or Countess of Montpezat. The original announcement sent shockwaves to the country and was met with disdain by Prince Joachim and his family. At the time, Queen Margrethe issued an apology for any hurt feelings, but didn't reverse her decision. Though perhaps it remains heavily on her mind, as she highlighted the fallout in her New Year's Eve address.
I always feel great love for my entire family. Difficulties and misunderstandings may arise in any family, also in mine. The whole country has witnessed that. The relationship with Prince Joachim and Princess Marie has run into difficulties, makes me sad.
The new year for many is a time for resolutions and clean slates. And that seems to be something that Queen Margrethe is hoping for too. She went on to say that her grandchildren are her great joy, and she hopes the family can enter 2023 together with confidence, understanding and new courage.
Rebecca Wood. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this one or any of the topics covered in it, do send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Stephanie Tillotson. The editor, Cara Martin. I'm Gareth Barlow. Until next time, goodbye.